This is Audible.
On the Historicity of Jesus, Why We Might Have Reason for Doubt. Written by Richard Carrier. Narrated by Richard Carrier. Special note for listeners to this audiobook. The print edition contains an enormous number of footnotes and an extensive bibliography. Those could not be included here. For those who need access to that material, I provide a chapter-by-chapter source list online at richardcarrier.info/bibliographies. Preface. This book is the second of two volumes examining a daring question: whether there is a case to be made that Jesus never really existed as a historical person. The alternative is that the Jesus we know originated as a mythical character, in tales symbolically narrating the salvific acts of a divine being who never walked the earth and probably never existed at all. Later, this myth was mistaken for history, or deliberately repackaged that way, and then embellished over time. Though I shall argue it's likely this alternative is true and that Jesus did not in fact exist, I cannot assume it has been conclusively proved here. In fact, it may yet be proved false in future work, using the very methods I employ, which were proposed and defended in my previous volume, Proving History, Bayes' Theorem, and the Quest for the Historical Jesus. Hence, the point of this book is not to end the debate, but to demonstrate that scholars need to take this hypothesis more seriously before dismissing it out of hand, and that they need much better arguments against it than they've heretofore deployed. A better refutation is needed, and a better theory of historicity, which, actually, credibly, explains all the oddities in the evidence. If this book inspires nothing else, I'll be happy if it's that. But this book may do more. It might inspire more experts to agree with the possibility, at least, that Jesus Christ was born in myth, not history. And their continuing examination of the case may yet result in a growing consensus against the grain of current assumptions. Either outcome would satisfy me. For my biases are such as to make no difference what the result should be. I only want the truth to be settled. Nevertheless, all historians have biases, and only sound methods will prevent those from too greatly affecting our essential results. No progress in historical knowledge, in fact, no historical knowledge at all, would be possible without such methods. Hence, my previous volume developed a formal historical method for approaching this or any other debate, which will produce as objectively credible a conclusion as any honest historian can reach. One need merely plug all the evidence into that method to get a result. However, because this volume can't address every single item of evidence, it merely addresses the best evidence there is, its conclusion may yet be brought down, even with its own method, simply by introducing something it omits. If so, I welcome it. Though I already discussed my biases and background, and the origin of this project, in the preface to Proving History, for the reader's convenience I shall repeat that here. I am a marginally renowned atheist, known across America and many other corners of the world as an avid defender of a naturalist worldview and a dedicated opponent of the abuse of history in the service of supernaturalist creeds. I am a historian by training and trade. I received my PhD in ancient history from Columbia University, and a philosopher by experience and practice. I have published peer-reviewed articles in the field and am most widely known for my book on the subject, Sense and Goodness Without God, A Defense of Metaphysical Naturalism. I have always assumed without worry that Jesus was just a guy, another merely human founder of an entirely natural religion, whatever embellishments to his cult and story may have followed. I'd be content if I were merely reassured of that fact. For the evidence, even at its best, supports no more startling a conclusion. So I have no vested interest in proving Jesus didn't exist. It makes no difference to me if he did. I suspect he might not have, but then that's a question that requires a rigorous and thorough examination of the evidence before it can be confidently declared. Most secular scholars agree. Even when they believe Jesus existed, they do not need to believe that. Believers, by contrast, and their apologists in the scholarly community cannot say the same. For them, if Jesus didn't exist, then their entire worldview topples. The things they believe in, and need to believe in, more than anything else in the world will then be under dire threat. It would be hard to expect them ever to overcome this bias, which makes bias a greater problem for them than for me. They need Jesus to be real, but I don't need Jesus to be a myth. Most atheists agree, and yet so much dubious argument has appeared on both sides of this debate, including argument of such a technical and erudite character that laypeople can't decide whom to trust, that a considerable number of atheists approached me with a request to evaluate the arguments on both sides and tell them whose side has the greater merit or whether we can even decide between them on the scanty evidence we have. That's how my involvement in this matter began, resulting in my mostly but not solely positive review of Erhel Doherty's The Jesus Puzzle. My continued work on the question has now culminated in over 40 philanthropists, some of them Christians, donating a collective total of $20,000 for Atheists United, a major American educational charity, to support my research and writing of a series of books in the hopes of giving both laypeople and experts a serious evaluation of the evidence they can use to decide who is more probably right. The first step in that process was to assess the methods so far employed on the subject and replace them if faulty. I accomplished that in the previous volume, in which I demonstrated that the most recent method of using historicity criteria in the study of Jesus has been either logically invalid or factually incorrect, and that only arguments structured according to Bayes' theorem have any chance of being valid and sound. Here I apply that method to the evidence for Jesus and show what results. Though this is a work of careful scholarship, the nature of its aims and funding necessitate a style that is approachable to both experts and laypeople. By the requirements of my grant, I am writing as much for my benefactors as my fellow scholars. But there is a more fundamental reason for my frequent use of contractions, slang, verbs in the first person, and other supposed taboos. It's how I believe historians should speak and write. Historians have an obligation to reach wider audiences with a style more attractive and intelligible to ordinary people, and they can do so without sacrificing rigor or accuracy. Indeed, more so than any other science, history can be written in ordinary language without excess of reliance on specialized vocabulary, though we do need some, and without need of any stuffy protocols of language that don't serve a legitimate purpose. As long as what we write is grammatically correct, accurate, and clear, and conforms to spoken English, it should satisfy all the aims of history: to educate and inform and advance the field of knowledge. This very book, just like the last, has been written to exemplify and hopefully prove that point. The support I received for this work has been very generous. As before, I must thank Atheists United for all their aid and assistance, and all those individual donors who gave so much and for little in return but an honest report. No one, not even Atheists United, who provided me with the financial grant and aid, nor any donor to that fund, was given any power to edit or censor the content of this work or to compel any particular result. They all gave me complete academic freedom. That also means I alone am responsible for everything I write. Atheists United wanted to see what I came up with and trusted me to do good work on the strength of my reputation and qualifications, but they do not necessarily agree with or endorse anything I say or argue. The same follows for any individual donors. More particular thanks are in order for them, who made this work possible. Benefactors came not only from all over the United States, but from all over the world, from Australia and Hong Kong to Norway and the Netherlands, even Poland and France. Not all wanted to be thanked by name, but of those who did or didn't object, my greatest gratitude goes to the most generous contributors: Jeremy A. Christian, Paul Doland, Dr. Evan Fales, Brian Fleming, Scott and Kate Jensen, Fab Lishka, and most generous of all, Michelle Ree and Maciek Kojojejczyk. Next in line are those who also gave very generously, including Aaron Adair, John and Susan Baker, Robert A. Bosak Jr., John Corteliu, Valerie Mills Daly, Brian Dewhurst, Kareem Gontus, Frank O. Glomset, Paul Hatchman, Jim Lepard, Ryan Miller, Dr. Edwin Newman, Lillian Painter, Benjamin Schult, Vern Shepard, Chris Stoffel, James Tracy, Stuart Turner, Keith Warner, Jonathan Whitmore, Dr. Alexander D. Young, Frank Zindler, and Damian Zoer. But I am grateful even for the small donors, whose gifts collectively added up to quite a lot, including the generosity of David F. Browning, David Empey, Landon Hedrick, Gordon McCormick, and many others. This book would never have been written without all their support. Many even provided valuable advice toward improving it. It is very rewarding to present this book, as I did the last, to those who respect and enjoy my work enough to keep me employed just to educate themselves and the public about what many consider an obscure issue, and above all, who have patiently waited so long for the payoff. Special thanks also go to David Fitzgerald, author of The Mormons and Nailed, 10 Christian Myths That Show Jesus Never Existed at All, for his help, advice, and friendship, and to Earl Doherty, author of The Jesus Puzzle and Jesus Neither God Nor Man, and even Evan Fales, who may one day come out with Reading Sacred Texts, An Anthropological Approach to the Gospel of St. Matthew, for their particular assistance and perspective. I don't always agree with them, but their often brilliant work did influence me, even if not always in the direction they may have hoped. Chapter 1. The Problem. Mark Goodacre once wrote, quote, "There is a widespread view that it is futile to go back and dig up old foundations, to go back over matters that were established long ago. Why not accept the sound results of a century's worth of good scholarship and get on instead with building on those pillars of scholarly wisdom?" End quote. He was, of course, speaking rhetorically. Section 1. Isn't this just bunk? In 1999, I wrote an exposé for Skeptical Inquirer on a then-recent Fox documentary about ancient Egypt. I had never been interested in the crazy theories going around about the pyramids, but when a major television network started presenting them as credible news, and with suspect tactics at that, it offended me as a historian. So I investigated the claims in the documentary, contacting some who were interviewed for it, and wrote on what I found. The show's editors had quoted interviews out of context, conflated credible with ridiculous claims, mixed serious scholars with lay theorists as if there were no difference in their credibility, made several claims that were highly dubious if not outright false, while rarely presenting any criticism and then only a token, and sometimes even misrepresented or didn't honestly reveal to those being interviewed what the actual intent of the documentary was and how their interview would be used. Some of those interviewed were rightly outraged at what Fox had done. Thanks to that article, however, I had sealed my fate. Ever since, I've been the target of countless emails from kooks that some people call pyramidiots, people who passionately advocate bizarre and often, let's be honest, stupid theories about the pyramids. They were built in 20,000 BCE. Their builders must have used lasers and levitation rays. Psychics have predicted archaeological discoveries in them. Their configuration proves the existence of extraterrestrial civilizations or the preternatural wisdom of the ancients or the existence of God and the intelligent design of the universe, and so on. They typically have some 1,000-page treatise they want me to read that, they insist, proves their new outlandish claim, and if I don't read it, I'm participating in the quote-unquote conspiracy to suppress their research. Yet I will never live long enough to examine and fact-check all the theories, books, and papers these people have tried to send me, even if I made it my single purpose in life to try. So I don't waste even a minute on any of them. I dismiss them all out of hand. Their emails and treatises go right in the trash. I will, however, send them one email in reply with a simple rule. Get even one of their novel claims published in a peer-reviewed journal specializing in Egyptology or archaeology, or in a book published by a respected academic or peer-reviewed press, and then I'll read it. They will insist they can't because of some conspiracy by the quote-unquote establishment to prevent acceptance of any such paper, either for some ordinary or paranoid reason. It differs with each one. But as a professional in the field, I know firsthand that's just bunk. If you really have the evidence and can prove it, the scholarly community will usually publish it. Our conversation then ends. This isn't the only subject on which I get this kind of crank email. It was just, for a time, the most pronounced and continuous. And silly, since I'm not an Egyptologist and have no interest in the field. I only published on the subject as a journalist, and that only once long ago. But I've published more widely on numerous other subjects and built a reputation as a skeptic and expert in various other areas, which inevitably attract similar people, from creationists to ufologists and everything in between. My response is always the same. After all, I have no choice. If I can't examine every pyramidiate scheme in a lifetime, I certainly can't examine every nutty scheme in hundreds of other fields besides. Hence my rule. Unless they get something published properly, I'm not warranted in spending any time on it. That's the way it has to be. So when I was approached by people claiming Jesus didn't exist, I simply assumed this was more of the same. Since I'm an expert in ancient history, and particularly in historical methods and the origins of Christianity, it at least made more sense why advocates of that crazy idea would start sending me things. But more than that happened. A growing number of skeptics, not just advocates, started approaching me and asking about these claims. They said the arguments sounded pretty convincing, and they hadn't seen any credible debunking of them, yet weren't qualified themselves to know if they were being duped by sloppy or dishonest scholarship. I responded to these sincere inquiries with the same general reply. The non-existence of Jesus is simply not plausible, as arguments from silence in the matter aren't valid, nor could they ever be sufficient to challenge what is, after all, the near-universal consensus of well-qualified experts. I would briefly explain why, but then more questions would come. Occasionally, I would point out what was wrong with this or that ridiculous claim, either factually or methodologically. There are certain plenty of nonsense going around from deniers of Jesus' historicity, so it's never hard to find something too silly to credit. But eventually enough people in the atheist and skeptical community, people whose judgment I trusted, were asking me to at least read The Jesus Puzzle by Earl Doherty and report on its merits, which was published by the Canadian Humanist Press in 2000, with a sequel, Jesus, Neither God Nor Man, published in 2009. He wasn't the only or the first author to argue the point, but everyone agreed he was the one who made the most convincing case. Normally, as with all crank claims, I wouldn't acquiesce, but instead insist that Doherty get at least one peer-reviewed paper published before I'd bother. He had, in the Journal of Higher Criticism, but as that journal has the specific agenda of publishing essentially those kinds of argument, an appearance there wasn't an entirely convincing reason to pay more attention. But once the number of requests from respectable people reached a tipping point, I decided I'd give his book a go, hoping that would be the end of it, and I would at least get a good article out of it, which I could then direct everyone to once and for all. I resolved to essentially peer review his book, the way I would any paper submitted to a journal. But the result surprised me. I found his book well-researched, competently argued, devoid of any of the ridiculous claims I'd heard from other historicity deniers, and more convincing than I'd thought possible. In my critical review, I pointed out the merits and flaws of his book, including the sorts of things I would insist upon as a peer reviewer before accepting it for academic publication. But on balance, the merits were greater. He had a good case. I wasn't entirely convinced, but I was convinced the subject deserved more research. And so my journey began. Section 2. The Debate Today. Jesus Christ is the standard appellation for the man who either founded or inspired the Christian religion. There were many men named Jesus back then. In fact, it was among the most common of names. The name is actually Joshua. Jesus is just a different way to spell it now. Adding Christ thus designates the particular Jesus who, one way or another, intentionally or not, got the whole movement called Christianity started, a religion that worshipped this Jesus as the Christ, which simply means anointed, the very thing meant by Messiah. Hence, the Jesus we're concerned with here is Jesus Christ as now understood. Many scholars believe that Christ is a name or label attached to Jesus after his death, beginning a pattern of increasing legendary development upon a humbler story of some real man named Jesus. But not all scholars agree. In fact, there is no identifiable consensus about who or what Jesus was, or when or why he acquired the moniker of Christ. And while all these scholars debate or even ignore one another in all of this, for over 100 years now, some scholars, and not just cranks, have argued there was no Jesus Christ in any real sense at all. They maintain the Christian religion began with the idea of a mythical man, not a historical one. The historical Jesus, on their account, was entirely a legendary development, eclipsing the original myth and leaving us with the mistaken impression that there must have been a real Jesus who was later known as Christ. For this book, I'll dub those who maintained there was a real Jesus of some relevant sort, historicists, and those who argue this Jesus was mythical, mythicists. Though there have been many valid criticisms of mythicists, many of the same objections apply to historicists as well, who have often made just as many mistakes of fact and method. And if we allow historicism to become respectable by limiting its claims to what can be reasonably proved, leaving aside all speculation and conjecture and error as simply that and nothing more, we should give mythicism the same opportunity. Yet in practice, there is no consensus even among historicists as to what is historical about Jesus and what not, and what is instead legendary or mythical or merely erroneous. Indeed, these unresolved disagreements extend to almost every significant question about Jesus. Nevertheless, most scholars agree some elements of the things said about Jesus aren't historically true, and many even conclude most are. Mythicists just continue going in the same direction other scholars have already been heading. But do they go too far? In Jesus Outside the New Testament, Robert Van Voorst lists 7 general counterarguments against mythicism, and this constitutes a typical summary of the case usually made against it. But that case is rather weak. Van Voorst says mythicists tend to overstate the strength of their arguments from silence. Yet, as I'll show in coming chapters, those arguments don't have to be overstated to be compelling. Van Voorst says mythicists tend to date all the Gospels unreasonably late, after 100 AD. Yet mythicism doesn't require this, and even mainstream scholars are starting to agree some of the Gospels might indeed be that late. Van Voorst says mythicists overstate the implications of the widely acknowledged mythic elements, legendary developments, and contradictions in the Gospels. Yet he acknowledges these elements exist, which can still support a mythicist theory without being overstated. Van Voorst says mythicists tend to be far too skeptical of the authenticity of the earliest non-biblical and even many biblical passages about Jesus. Yet mythicism does not require such excessive skepticism, and some of it is not excessive. Van Voorst also objects that mythicists often have an anti-Christian agenda, which is certainly true, but that is not relevant to the merit of their work. He further objects that no ancient critic of Christianity challenged the historical reality of Jesus. But that's not quite true, as even Van Voorst admits in a footnote, and as I'll show later, he misses yet more examples. And it's impertinent anyway, since we have no criticisms of Christianity of any sort until well into the 2nd century, far too late for such critics to know the real truth of the matter, especially if Christians themselves had forgotten or weren't telling. Hence, if the idea of a historical Jesus was already developing in the latter half of the 1st century, then Van Voorst's own objection to overstating an argument from silence turns against him. For we cannot argue from the silence of documents we don't have, and we don't have any 1st century documents from critics of Christianity. Hence, we cannot know what such critics were saying, because no one tells us. Some will claim that Matthew 28, verses 11 to 15, is the one exception, but that's still a Christian source that can't be usefully dated or traced to anyone who actually knew the facts of the matter, rather than was merely gainsaying a gospel they heard. Even if it was based on fact, and it is in fact a Christian fabrication. It only makes sense in the context of Matthew's unique story, which is obviously fictional, and is a response to Mark's story, which is probably just as fictional. And thus, it cannot actually be linked to any real critics of Christianity, much less critics who would be in any position to know there was no Jesus. Finally, Van Voorst says mythicists, quote, have failed to advance other credible hypotheses to account for the birth of Christianity and fashioning of a historical Christ, end quote. And as a result, quote, biblical scholars and classical historians now regard mythicism as effectively refuted, end quote. Yet that conclusion depends on the merits of his use of the word credible. Most mythicists, in fact, start by constructing hypotheses for the origin and development of Christianity, and then argue that the evidence fits their scenario better than any other. Whether these efforts are credible remains to be determined. For it is not demonstrated by anything Van Voorst argues, and whether it is demonstrated by anything anyone else argues, we can only begin to ask after reading the present book, or other more recent books, since Van Voorst wrote before he could examine the superior work of more recent mythicists such as Earl Doherty, or Thomas Thompson, or Thomas Brody, and no one of Van Voorst's caliber has yet addressed their arguments properly either. Bart Ehrman, in Did Jesus Exist? The Historical Argument for Jesus of Nazareth, published in 2012, attempted to provide one, but that's essentially a careless and poorly researched popular market book and not a proper scholarly critique. You can review my demonstrations of this on my blog. A summary with links to my more detailed discussions is available in Richard Carrier, quote, Ehrman on the Historicity Recap, end quote, at Richard Carrier Blogs. Maurice Casey did the same thing, only worse, in Jesus, Evidence and Argument or Mythicist Myths, published in 2014. For a critical review of that, See Richard Carrier, quote, "Critical Review of Maurice Casey's Defense of the Historicity of Jesus," end quote, at Richard Carrier Blogs. In other words, the case against mythicism, at least as represented by Van Voorst, for example, consists of arguing that there are flaws, mostly flaws of exaggeration, in the scholarship of mythicists, yet without demonstrating that any of those flaws are actually relevant. That scholars err does not automatically disqualify the rest of their work or their conclusions. And the fact that exaggerated premises are unwarranted does not entail that the same conclusion cannot be reached from more moderate premises instead. Thus, his every argument is a non sequitur. Only one of Van Voorst's arguments bears on the actual evidence rather than its abuse, and that argument isn't logically valid either, for his argument from silence stands refuted by his own reasoning. Yet that doesn't mean mythicism is vindicated. It's still a fallacy to declare a conclusion true merely because arguments against it are fallacious. Just because Van Voorst identifies no valid objection to mythicism does not mean mythicism has merit. After all, it might be possible to expand or qualify his objections into a successful refutation. And Van Voorst cites various scholars who have attempted this, and in many other respects, his section on this topic remains required reading. But that has to actually be done before anyone can claim it has been. And merely refuting one theory, such as Doherty's, won't suffice at that, any more than refuting a single conception of a historical Jesus is sufficient to refute all conceptions of a historical Jesus. Therefore, it's necessary to test a minimal theory of historicity, such that if even that theory isn't true, then none are, against a minimal theory of myth, such that if that theory isn't true, then no other is likely to be. And this test must be logically valid and give the best possible opportunity to either theory before whatever conclusion we reached can be considered fair. Section 3. Myth versus History. As I demonstrated in the first chapter of Proving History, many contradictory theories of a historical Jesus are defended today. Some joke that there are as many theories of Jesus as there are scholars to propose them. Each different conception of the historical Jesus and his relationship to the origins of the Christian religion will here be called a theory of historicity. Such a theory aims to explain all extant evidence by proposing that certain things are true of the historical Jesus and his influence, and that certain things are not true, or not known to be true, of the historical Jesus and his influence. The latter cannot be separated from the former. For proposing to explain any evidence as a later development in the church entails that that evidence was not caused by anything Jesus said or did, or had said or done to him. In practice, of course, an honest historian has to admit she often doesn't know how some particular development in the evidence came about, and thus doesn't know whether it's in any way causally linked to a historical Jesus or not. But even then, she will be saying, in effect, that the probabilities are roughly equal either way, which still entails taking a particular position as to what's possible or likely. Anyone who examines the literature of the present generation of scholars will find that, indeed, by this standard, there are almost as many theories of historicity as there are experts to pronounce them, and there is no apparent consensus as to whose theory is more probably correct, nor any indication of such a consensus developing anytime soon. But just as there are countless theories of historicity, there are also countless Jesus myth theories. Indeed, just as with historicism, there are almost as many Jesus myth theories as there are experts to pronounce them, and the range of these theories is truly marvelous, from the more ridiculous, for example, the bulk of the New Testament is a hoax perpetrated by the Roman senatorial elite, to the less ridiculous, for example, the original Jesus stories were a clever political metaphor against the ruling elite, to the least ridiculous, which I shall explore here, that the earliest Christians preached a celestial being named Jesus Christ, then later this godlike figure was fictionally placed in a historical setting just as other gods were, and the original concept eventually forgotten, dismissed, or suppressed. I think most scholars, once informed of the underlying facts, would agree only the latter has any plausibility, if there is any plausibility to be had. So any Jesus myth theory that entails rejecting even that is probably a theory of no likelihood worth considering. I'll have more to say about this and what the minimal theory of historicity must be to compete against it in the next two chapters. But even then, whatever theory is proposed, It is often immediately weighed down with an enormous array of elaborations, which are often significantly less defensible than the core theory alone would have been. Yet one should never propose more than is necessary to explain the evidence. The more complex a theory has to be, the less likely it is to be true. Hence, I'll assume for convenience that what I just suggested is the most plausible theory is the only plausible theory, and attempt to explain and present it as simply as possible with no unnecessary elaborations. For if even that theory cannot be shown to be more credible than historicity, it's unlikely any other theory will succeed where it failed. However, I do allow that I can be proven wrong about that, on this matter as in anything else, if someone ever presents evidence presently unknown to me that adequately supports some other theory. And in proving history, I laid out a sound method by which that could be done. The same method I will use here. Section 4. Mythicists versus Historicists. Though many mythicists may seem as crazy as their theories, the proposal of mythicism itself is not crazy. A model example is King Arthur. Like Jesus, many detailed historical narratives and biographical facts about this great king are on record, along with a widespread belief that, like Jesus, he will one day return. Yet, after considerable inquiry, it seems almost certain no such man ever existed. Michael Wood provides a good summary of how myths like this arise and why, and how the Arthur legend incorporates old stories and elements from various cultures and times and persons, both real and fictional, which were all co-opted and incorporated into Arthur's story, including elements from British, Scottish, Welsh, and French traditions, and from both Christian and Celtic pagan religions. King Arthur was essentially created by assembling pieces from numerous facts and myths into a new, unified, and unifying myth that had great cultural resonance, persisting even to this day. This myth essentially became historicized by a culture-wide application of an affective fallacy. The more powerfully a story affects a people, emotionally and morally, the more it is believed to be real. Eventually, the truth of what the story symbolized was confused with the truth of the story itself. There is nothing crazy or bizarre about that. Mainstream historians are entirely comfortable with King Arthur being a mythical hero historicized by some such process, even if they debate the exact details or confess the details can't be known. Of course, the King Arthur legend developed over centuries, but centuries are not required, as I'll show in Chapter 6. One prominent example studied of late is the rapid historicization of the mythical Ned Ludd. As the supposed founder of the Luddite movement, Ned Ludd had many contradictory traditions arise about him quite rapidly. In fact, within 40 years of his alleged techno-sabotage in 1779, an event that historians have failed to find any evidence of. Nor have they discovered any evidence of the man at all, despite a vastly better survival of books and records than is enjoyed for any period of antiquity. We even have daily newspapers. And yet, already, by 1810, he was a revered hero and imagined founder of a movement of anti-technocrats known as the Luddites. And all manner of stories were circulating about him. Letters were forged in his name, and eventually biographical novels about him were written. Though Ned Ludd's non-existence cannot be decisively proved, this is true of almost any myth. But in this case, the evidence for the man being a myth seems as compelling as it could ever be expected to be. Yet, again, mainstream historians are not shocked by this. The notion that Ned Ludd is a myth is not considered crazy. The King Arthur legend sold a particular product, a unified England. Anyone who believed dearly in that goal was likely to believe dearly in King Arthur. The message and the story were eventually regarded as one and the same, the symbolism so powerful and passions so high that to deny the one was to deny the other. Likewise, the Ned Ludd myth fueled a protest movement by providing a hero and a mission to rally behind, again with the aim of generating unity. In fact, there were many separate movements that co-opted the Ned Ludd story, each in their own way, and a unified story about him only evolved later. The same thing happened in Polynesian cargo cults, which still revere completely mythical heroes who were nevertheless quite rapidly placed in history and believed to be real, most famously Tom Navy and John Frum. Again, within mere decades of their supposed appearance, and again serving the aim of creating unity and a moral authority to commend. I'll discuss this more in Chapter 5, under Element 29. Much the same could be claimed of Christianity, with different movements co-opting the Jesus story to promote their own ideals, and a unified church arising only later. The aim would always be the same, to promote unity within the movement and, it would be hoped, society, by promoting a popular myth to rally behind and believe in. And often success at that depended on selling the myth as true, as with King Arthur or Ned Ludd, so with Jesus Christ. To deny the historicity of these men or their stories would quickly become tantamount to denying the unifying message their stories were crafted and employed to sell. Promoting their historicity also made it easier to effect moral reform by attaching the authority for that reform to a historical person, because a made-up man was not generally considered capable of having any moral authority at all. Even in biblical studies, there is nothing new or crazy about this idea. The patriarchs are safely assumed now to be non-historical and thus entirely mythical. This is no longer considered radical or fringe, but is in fact the most widespread mainstream view among scholars, as I'll discuss in Chapter 5 under Element 44. Thus, Moses is now regarded as fictional. Yet like Jesus, he performed miracles, had a whole family and huge numbers of followers, gave speeches and had travels, and dictated laws. No mainstream historian today believes the Book of Deuteronomy was even written in the same century as Moses, much less by Moses, or that it preserves anything Moses actually said or did, yet it purports to do so, at extraordinary length and in remarkable detail. No real historian today would accept as valid an argument like, Moses had to have existed because so many sayings and teachings were attributed to him. And yet, if this argument is invalid for Moses, it's invalid for Jesus. Similarly, it's now the mainstream view that the Book of Daniel was written in the 2nd century BC and is a complete fiction, representing the elaborate adventures and speeches of the 6th century prophet Daniel as if they were a fact. Historians doubt even the existence of Daniel. But even if he existed, historians are certain the Book of Daniel does not contain anything he authentically said or did. Rather, this Daniel, and everything he is supposed to have said and done, was invented to create a historical authority for a new vision of society, to inspire a new unity and a new moral order against the immoral rule of dominating foreigners. We must accept that the same is at least possible for Jesus. So the idea that Jesus was originally mythical, like King Arthur or Ned Ludd or Moses or Daniel, is not inherently crazy. It could only be called crazy if the evidence for a historical Jesus were substantially more impressive than the evidence for the historicity of the likes of King Arthur or Ned Ludd or Moses or Daniel. Whether that's the case is what the present book will examine. But an increasing number of mainstream scholars are starting to at least reconsider the question. A conference sponsored by the Center for Inquiry's Committee for the Scientific Examination of Religion in Amherst, New York in December of 2008 gathered numerous reputable historians to begin debating how much we could even claim to know about the historical Jesus, and most agreed the answer was very little or even nothing. In fact, a growing number of mainstream experts are expressing doubt that much of anything can be reliably known about the historical Jesus, as I showed in the first chapter of Proving History, and as I'll show in Chapter 3 here, more are coming to the side of doubt. Nevertheless, this book won't defend any particular mythicist, whether the experts I name in Chapter 3 or the many amateurs who've published their own cases. In my observation, the mythicist case has often been mired in or mixed up with poor, questionable, or obsolete scholarship, therefore giving the impression that it isn't worth looking at, because in such a state it doesn't look either strong or valid. Until mainstream scholars start seriously examining their arguments in proper detail and only dismissing the bad instead of the good along with the bad, they won't even know if the case is strong or valid. But the fault here largely falls on the mythicists, who have failed to police the bad scholarship among their ranks with appropriate criticism, have failed to develop or employ any clear methodology in defense of their own conclusions, and have failed to distinguish the core of their argument from the excesses of speculation they pile upon it. But this chief failing of the mythicists is much the same as the chief failing of the historicists. It's inordinately easy to make any theory fit the facts, or to make the facts fit any theory. Consequently, as I demonstrated in the first chapter of Proving History, historicists defend dozens of completely contradictory theories of the historical Jesus, and yet all are accepted as plausible by mainstream academia, even though such acceptance should be a scandal. A field that generates dozens of contradictory conclusions about the same subject is clearly bereft of anything like a reliable method. But the very same flaw befalls the mythicists, whose community is likewise plagued by dozens of completely contradictory theories of the Jesus myth. If such a state is a scandal for historicity, and it should be, it is equally a scandal for mythicism. The passionate certainty with which every historicist and mythicist defends their own theory of the evidence is far out of proportion to what the evidence could ever support. All the more so, since logic entails that, even at most, only one of them can be right, and therefore almost all of them must be wrong. In fact, it's entirely possible all of them are wrong. The first conclusion this should impress upon you is that, even if you are convinced, perhaps by this very book, that Jesus probably didn't exist, you should not then simply trust that any additional claims supporting that conclusion are true or sound. There is a lot of bad scholarship on this subject, which advances claims with far more confidence than is at all warranted, or rests on assumptions that are anything but established, or relies on facts that simply aren't true. In short, if you are a layperson in this matter, exercise extreme caution when reading or listening to myth advocates. What I discuss here throughout this book about proper methodology should always be applied to them. But for the very same reasons, if you are an expert, don't let the existence of bad scholarship defending this same conclusion lead you to believe that good scholarship could never get the same result. The second conclusion all this should impress upon you is that, even if you are not convinced that Jesus probably didn't exist, you should not then simply trust that historicity has been well defended. Historicists have a lot of work to do before they can claim to have their house in order. Their sins are many. They have far too quickly assumed that various fundamental conclusions in the field are settled, which in fact are not, such as the dating of the New Testament documents, as I'll discuss in Chapter 7. They have routinely overstated what the evidence can actually prove, conflating conjectures with demonstrable facts almost as often as mythicists do. And they lack anything like a coherent methodology, both of which I extensively demonstrated in Proving History. They have also frequently ignored, denied, or somehow remained ignorant of key facts. I've met many historians of Jesus who didn't know many of the things I will survey in this book, almost none of which should be controversial anymore. They also tend to dismiss criticism far too quickly, without addressing it or even paying attention to it. They often simply mishandle the evidence, such as assuming the Gospels are historical narratives rather than symbolic myths, despite conclusive evidence of the latter, as I'll prove in Chapter 10. Or overlooking what is obviously missing from the Book of Acts, which we should expect to be there if Jesus existed, as I'll show in Chapter 9. Or vastly overplaying the value of the extra-biblical evidence, as I'll demonstrate in Chapter 8. Or overestimating how much they can honestly explain away. But all that still does not entail the mythicists are right, any more than the similar failings of the mythicists entail they are wrong. It only entails that historicists are wrong to simply dismiss all the challenges posed by mythicists, because the historicists still have a great deal of work to do that, so far, they are only pretending has been done. But since both houses are in a mess, both have a great deal of work to do. Admitting this is the first step toward progress. Section 5. The aim of this book. This book will advance the debate in two respects. It will survey the most relevant evidence for and against the historicity of Jesus, and it will do so with the fewest unnecessary assumptions, testing the simplest theories of historicity and myth against each other. But one thing this book is not is a comprehensive survey of all evidence, theories, and arguments of mythicists and historicists alike. Though one can begin to explore the history of this debate and the many different theories of both sides by following some of the references throughout this book, in chapters 2 and 3 especially, my aim is not to attack or defend any particular scholar or work, but rather to construct the most defensible version of each position, which in either case will be a simpler and less ambitious theory than any heretofore defended, and test their relative merits against the most pertinent evidence. But since this book intends only to begin, not end, a proper debate, I hope to see it carefully critiqued by experts in the field. I want to see a scholarly and constructive debate develop that will advance the entire discussion, resolving matters of methodology, if nothing else, Such a debate should already have begun over the release of Proving History, but hopefully also making a clear, objectively defensible case, either for or against the historicity of Jesus, one that all reasonable experts can agree is sound. In his own excellent book on the origins of Christian myth traditions, Burton Mack provides a list of scholars and their recent diverse work that needs to be synthesized and applied to reconstructing the origins of Christianity, which provides a major example of the kind of work that really does need to be done. Like Mack, throughout this book, I will cite many scholars whose work also needs to be synthesized and applied to the same result. Above all, historians need to apply serious energy to resolving the issues of dating and authorship surveyed in Chapter 7. Since the theories I will compare here are the minimal ones, the simplest possible theories that I think have any chance of explaining the evidence, many on both sides of the debate will want to do one better and defend more elaborate theories of historicity or mythicism. But if mythicists want to expand on a minimal theory at all, or conversely, if historicists want to defend any more elaborate theory of historicity than I present, I ask that they do so responsibly, with sound methodology, according to the standards set out in Proving History. Even if you reject those methods, you must replace them with methods more defensible. So you have to defend those alternative methods, which means you must demonstrate that they are, in fact, a more defensible means of getting at the truth. In other words, that they will produce reliable results that we can all trust. And above all, to advance beyond the present work, mythicists need to be as restrained in their claims and as rigorous in their dependence on evidence as they expect historicists to be, and vice versa. Finally, however, one last remark is needed on mistaking Christian apologetics for objective or even mainstream scholarship, a point I'll briefly revisit in the next chapter. It will not be the aim of this book to debunk apologetic reconstructions of the historical Jesus or the origins of Christianity. I take only secular scholarship seriously, which doesn't mean secular scholars, since a great deal of secular scholarship is produced by the devout, but rather scholars who rely on secular methods and principles of scholarship, a good example being the late Raymond Brown. Because apologetics differs from scholarship, apologists ignore methodological distinctions between the possible and the probable in order to maintain the defensibility of a religious dogma. But that isn't how objective scholars behave. If it is realistically possible that Jesus didn't exist, then it is no longer possible to argue that we know he existed. We can only argue that he may have existed, or probably did. This would not be an unusual result in the field of history, but on this specific subject, it presents a threat to traditional religion, a threat recognized by Christian apologists who will disregard facts and logic in opposing it if they have to. This threat to religion is also recognized by many mythicists who do indeed have an agenda against Christianity, some perhaps spiteful, though most simply out of ire against apologists whom they perceive as having lied to them and manipulated the evidence in defense of completely untenable theories of historicity. Some mythicists thus conflate what apologists argue, a triumphalist theory of the historical Jesus, with what is far more defensible, a far more mundane theory of the historical Jesus. And in justified outrage against the former, unjustifiably attack all historicity, even the most defensible kind. This approach must be discarded, as must the apologetical kind. Neither should be accepted as legitimate. Both are driven by agendas to exclude credible and objective methods and claims. Section 6. Summary of remaining chapters. The argument of this book can be summarized as follows. A Bayesian argument requires attending to the question of applicable background knowledge, constructing therefrom a prior probability for all competing hypotheses, and then evaluating the consequent probabilities, the likelihoods, of all the evidence on each hypothesis. In accordance with this method, I must formally define the hypotheses to be compared, that of historicity in Chapter 2, and that of myth in Chapter 3. In each case, I will define the simplest possible theory, which shall thus encompass all other more complex theories that have any claim to plausibility. Then I must set out all the applicable background knowledge that will affect our estimates of prior and consequent probability for these hypotheses. First, from the established history of Christianity and its origins, in Chapter 4, and then everything else pertaining to its historical context and comparable phenomena in other contexts, in Chapter 5. This is unfortunately necessary, I have found, because even the most erudite scholars in the field are unaware of most of it. Yet the origins and development of Christianity can only be understood in light of it. With all that background work done, then I must determine the relative prior probabilities of each hypothesis by ascertaining the clearest and most applicable reference class for which we have sufficient data, which I'll do in Chapter 6. Then I must determine the consequent probability of all the evidence on each hypothesis, which I will do by breaking the evidence down into categories and treating each separately but cumulatively after first attending to questions of dating and authorship in Chapter 7. The four categories I will develop will then each receive a chapter in the order of the latest to the earliest. The extra-biblical evidence, both secular and non-canonical, in Chapter 8, the canonical Acts in Chapter 9, the canonical Gospels in Chapter 10, and finally, the canonical epistles in Chapter 11. I will then tie everything together and argue for a conclusion in Chapter 12. Section 7. Applying Bayes' Theorem. I explained all the mechanics and technicalities of applying Bayes' Theorem to historical questions in Proving History, where I also answered every typical objection to this notion. Here I will only summarize the key points that will come up often in the present volume. To know whether any theory is the most probably true, you must compare it with all other viable theories. No theory can be defended in isolation. To effect such a comparison, you must establish four premises. Number one, the prior probability that the theory you are testing is true. Number two, the converse of which is the prior probability that some other theory is true instead. And then number three, the consequent probability that we would have all the evidence we actually have if your theory is true, and number four, the consequent probability that we would have all that same evidence if some other theory is true instead. From these four premises, a conclusion follows with logical necessity, which is simply the probability that your theory is true. To ascertain these probabilities with the kind of vague, problematic, and incomplete data typically encountered in historical inquiry, you must estimate all four probabilities as being as far against your most preferred theory as you can honestly and reasonably believe them to be. And you must present sufficient reasons and evidence for this conclusion in each case. This will produce a conclusion a fortiori, which you can assert with as high a confidence level as could ever be obtained on the available data, because any adjustment of your estimates towards what they truly are will then only make your conclusion even more certain. That way, since each premise consists of as unfavorable a probability as is reasonably defensible, you will know with logical certainty, if you have accounted for all the available evidence and done so correctly, that the probability your theory is true will be the probability you calculate, or higher, and often much higher. Conversely, you can be certain it is that probability or lower if you instead input estimates as far in favor of your theory as you can honestly believe. That conclusion only follows, of course, given all the knowledge and evidence available to you at the time. Hence, newly uncovered evidence can change your conclusion, which possibility is already accounted for by stating your conclusion as a probability. For example, if your conclusion is that your hypothesis, H, is true to a probability of 95%, and then some new evidence effectively proves H false, that possibility was already accounted for by your original allowance of a 5% chance that H was false, even before the new evidence appeared. And of course, even that new conclusion, that H is false, will be stated as a probability that could be overturned again if yet more evidence arises. Section 8. Elements and Axioms. Essential to a successful use of Bayes' theorem in historical analysis is a transparency of assumptions and inferences. First of all, I shall rely on the 12 rules and 12 axioms of historical method that I laid out in the second chapter of Proving History. Here, I shall also state my assumed background knowledge in chapters 2 through 7, which shall often consist of numbered elements, each being a particular claim to fact that requires an empirical defense, plus a set of basic definitions of terms I will frequently use. but once thus defended will be employed as an assumption of fact for the remainder of the book. This will allow my critics to more easily identify all of my assumptions for examination and challenge. Finally, the present work should be regarded as superseding all my prior work. Since my research for this book changed many of the views and conclusions I voiced in various places and publications before this, wherever contradictions may result with anything I have previously said or written, what I say in this book should be taken as my current opinion on the matter, and any previous claims or arguments of mine now contradicted should be regarded as revised or abandoned. That said, I first must turn to defining the two hypotheses that will be subjected to the following inquiry: the basic historicity hypothesis and the basic myth hypothesis. Chapter 2. The Hypothesis of Historicity. Section 1. Myth from History. It's quite common for historical persons to become surrounded by a vast quantity of myth and legend, and very rapidly, too, especially when they become the object of religious veneration. Thus, the fact that this happened never in itself argues that the person in question didn't exist. One relatively recent example is the elevation of the Ethiopian emperor Haile Selassie to the status of a god, by people he never asked this favor from and even repeatedly begged to stop. His deification and continued worship to this day is the foundation of the modern Rastafarian faith, which claims hundreds of thousands of adherents worldwide. It's telling that we know he professed to his death his own Christian faith and his continual despair at the fact that he had been elevated into a revered divinity so quickly, despite his protests. And one would think if your own god protested you're worshiping him, you'd listen, and yet here we are. Myths and legends about him quickly grew, even within his own lifetime, and all the more rapidly in the two decades after his death in 1975. And yet none had any basis in fact, at all. Yet still they remain the central affirmations of a living faith. The parallel with Jesus ought to be cautionary. If this could happen to Selassie, it could even more easily have happened to Jesus, there being no universal education or literacy, or even media per se, in the ancient world. Perhaps Jesus himself continually begged his followers not to worship him, yet they did anyway. We wouldn't know, because, unlike Selassie, the only records we have of Jesus are written by his devoted worshippers. So perhaps everything told about Jesus is just as made up as everything now told about Selassie. Yet it's told anyway. And not just told, but believed completely by every adherent of the faith, even in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. But not merely cautionary, but the factual parallels are numerous too. Edmund Standing summarizes this point elegantly. Looking at the status of Haile Selassie and the Rastafari religion, we find the following. 1. The coming to earth of a messianic figure who was prophesied in the Old Testament. 2. A birth accompanied by miracles. 3. A child with immense divinely given wisdom who possessed miraculous powers. 4. A messiah whose actions were prefigured in Old Testament writings. 5. A man who could perform miracles and in whose presence miracles occurred. 6. A man who was worshipped and held to be divine by thousands who had not even met him. 7. A man who was the incarnation of God and who continues to live on despite evidence of his death. 8. A man who is prayed to and communicated with by his followers. And 9. A savior who will one day return to gather up a chosen people who will live under his rule in a kingdom of God. Despite the facts related to the actual historical figure of Selassie, as we see, Rastafarians have built an extensive religious mythology around him, and even did so within his lifetime. Quote, imagine if, at some point in the future, the vast bulk of the historical record was lost, and that the only records of Selassie's existence that had survived were the devotional accounts of Rastafarians. Then the only story historians would have to work with would be made up of layers of mythology, the story of Selassie, a man who arose in a time in which Ethiopians were excitedly awaiting the coming of a messiah, would be filled with references to the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecies, stories of miracles, tales of God walking the earth, and the denial of the reality of the messiah's death. They would read that Selassie is still alive and that part of the proof of this is that followers can communicate in spirit with him. As a result of this, surely there would be some who would adopt a mythicist position with regard to the historical Selassie, End quote. And yet, of course, if they did, they would be wrong. Because there really was a Selassie. He just wasn't anything even remotely like the narratives his worshippers wrote and told about him. In the scenario Standing imagines, the truth about the historical Selassie would have been completely lost. Fragments of the truth would remain in the surviving devotional texts of his worshippers, but without any independent sources to check them against, we would have no way to know which details were historical and which mythical. We are hardly in any better position